Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
To inform, inspire, and empower Alcoholics Anonymous sponsorship, locally and internationally, to be their very best, both personally and spiritually. This is the mission of RumRadio.org, an internet radio program dedicated to carrying the message of recovery to a world plagued by alcoholism and addiction. Alcoholism and addiction is the number one health issue in our world today, and RumRadio.org is actively participating in the solution. Interviews with a plethora of people sharing their experience, strength, and hope. Live Sundays at 9 p.m. Central Time and rewound again on Saturday and Monday. Tune in to 12-Stepology at its best on RumRadio.org.
Here we go. Come on, Mom.
Bravo.
That's my mom out there. Sometimes she just hesitates just a little bit. But the price is right. Thanks, Mom. Welcome and hello. This is Joseph G. with Rum Radio and RumRadio.org, the most comprehensive 12-step sponsorship in the known and the unknown universe. The unknown universe is squeezed down a little bit. The GSO, that's not the KGB, but the General Service Organization of Alcoholics Anonymous, through the auspices of The Grapevine, which is our monthly magazine in print, which is our meeting in print, comes out once a month, has produced a sponsorship book. It's called One-on-One Sponsorship. This is the first time this organization has produced a sponsorship book in 78 years since its inception. So evidently, they consider sponsorship to be in the forefront today of recovery, and we couldn't be more pleased with that. So I want to applaud their efforts to get more sponsorship out. I believe sponsorship is the key ingredient to recovery. A sponsor's job is to share his experience, strength, and hope to bring the new man to a belief in God, or we use a higher power. Some people think it's Hewlett-Packard, but it's a higher power. It's an ego-driven higher power, which means there's some power out there greater than the individual, because the individual by themselves could not attain and maintain long-term sobriety. So we have to start small, baby steps. Bill W. said, AA was spiritual kindergarten. So we take baby steps and do it that way. I'd like to acknowledge WNAH. It's Hoyt Carter and Tony the Horse, who affords us the opportunity to broadcast live to their listening audience in Nashville, parts of Kentucky, and Alabama. And they do this for us as a public service presentation. Thanks, guys. It helps. Every little bit. We would also like to acknowledge RecoveryToday.net magazine. It's one of the finer recovery journals, and they afford us some print space from time to time. I gratefully like to introduce my co-host, Harold B., a family intervention specialist. He does a fine work with troubled families. And I personally believe the families are the basic unit of our society, of our country, of our nation, and basically on the world. Most of the problems we face today in society have to do with children that were brought up as latchkey kids. The parents were not home. They grew up like vacant lot weeds. There was nobody there to teach them correct principles. So being in the gangs and being in the clubs, everybody, you know, we're social creatures and we huddle together. And this is where the drugs and alcohol started out. They didn't get those correct principles growing up. So when Harold also goes to the prisons, besides working with the families, and you go into the prisons, and most of the problems you'll find in the prisons are, fueled by drugs and alcohol. Crimes of opportunity fueled by drugs and alcohol. Now, we have career criminals. You're always going to have the horse thief looking for a free ride. But the majority of the problems today in our prisons are fueled by drugs and alcohol. So he goes in there. It's a tough work, but somebody's got to do it. So you're doing it, huh, Harold?
Yes, it's a privilege to be able to go in, and the state of Texas has had some funding cuts. So in the Houston area, we have Fort Bend County Jail, Harris County Jail are the two biggest facilities, and so things are changing a bit, but they still want us coming in and just helping to reduce recidivism. So I go in. The inmates really appreciate it. We've had two teams, the men's team and the women's team. That's been a really great way to give back. Speaking of giving back, I just wanted to mention to our listeners that this radio program is Joseph's way back, as is his website, rumradio.org. It's all dedicated to working with others and to sponsorship and to really how to deepen your recovery. Joseph doesn't make a penny on the website. In fact, he sunk thousands into it. And I just wanted to reiterate that because there is money to be made in the world of recovery, but we are so grateful just to be alive and grateful to the 12-step programs altogether. We wanted to do some things to give back, and this is what we're doing this particular time. So I appreciate that, Joseph. And I also wanted to mention that a real important part of recovery, if you go back to 1935 and read the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, you can see that the men and women really reached out to families a lot. That's still very important. It's a family illness. It's family recovery. So you folks out there in recovery, do not neglect the families. Reach out to the wives, the children of people that have drinking problems, and really let them know three basic things. One, they didn't cause it. Number two, they can't cure it. Number three, they've done nothing wrong. And so the role of Alcoholics Anonymous and of Al-Anon is to help people really learn to take care of themselves on a new level. After years of drinking problems, that can really be a challenge. That's what needs to be done. And it's been a very important part of my recovery. I'm a member of AA, of NA, of Celebrate Recovery. I'm also a member of Al-Anon because I had a dad who drank like a fish, spouse, an ex-spouse. My kids had problems. So I earned a seat in both groups, and I attend both. It's really important to keep a balanced perspective all of that. So you folks who are having problems with alcohol or drugs, and you also have family members, think about attending Narcanon or Al-Anon, and so you can learn to take better care of yourself. So that's enough out of me. Back to you, Joseph.
Thank you, Harold. A disclaimer, this is not AA. This is not NA. This is not CA. We're closer to Paranoids Anonymous. The only problem is nobody will tell you where they hold the meetings. If you can make it for the whole hour of the show, you might know what Narcoleptics Anonymous looks like. I would tell you this. I'm a refugee from several 12-step programs. We don't hold it tight. Drugs and alcohol are equal opportunity destroyers. We don't delineate between addictions. You know, as long as it's drugs and alcohol, we're in there. We know about that. Now, if it's about an eating disorder or Gambling Anonymous or Debtors Anonymous, that's a horse of a different color. Right now, we're interested and we're addressing sponsorship for drugs and alcohol. And this is where the information you'll find. There's a call-in number if you're interested in calling in, if you have any questions for our guest. It's 949-534-0621. Again, 949-534-0621. We also have an open chat room. The way you get there is you go to the website, rumradio.org. You click on that button, and that'll direct you. Harold, what do you do exactly? Once you get into the you click on the radio button up on the microphone on the website, and then what?
Well, you go to rumradio.org. In the upper right corner, you'll see the live button. You click that. You go down the right-hand column on the Blog Talk Radio website, and you will see how to ask questions on our chat room, which is on the right side of the Blog Talk Radio website. You find the Blog Talk Radio website by going to the rumradio.org website and clicking the live button.
Okay, thanks, Harold.
Did you get the number already?
I did.
Okay, great.
I could do it again, 949-534-0621. And in New Jersey, it's 949-534-0621. In the Philippines, you get the drift. That's the number. Give us a call if you'd like to talk to our guest. And tonight we have a special guest, Mike C. Mike C. is the honcho on the Rowdy Rum, which is a Facebook phenomenon. It's a recovery chat experience. People in recovery go and they discuss different things about recovery. Rowdy Rum is a little different in the sense that there's many conflicting opinions. You get 15 alcoholics in a room, you're going to get 20 opinions. One thing about being in recovery, nobody's ever wrong. You might not be right, but nobody's ever wrong. So sometimes it gets a little heated, and Mike makes sure that people stay within at least a veneer of civility. You there, Mike?
I'm here.
Okay, good. So if you just hold on for a moment while we get the show, I'd like to start off with the third step prayer. So if you just hold on for a minute, we're excited to hear your story, what it was like, what happened, what it's like now, and what keeps you maximum service to God and your fellows. So if you just hold tight for a minute, and we'll get some of the housekeeping out of the way. We like to start the show with a prayer. It's called a benediction. We do this in recovery most of the time. It's a way of encouraging the spirit to come in. And so what we say might touch someone and help them get a happy, joyous, and free life by attaining and then maintaining long-term recovery and sobriety, clean and sober. We find this to be the better way to do it, but there is a formula, certain things we hold in common. When I first get a sponsee, and this is the key, the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and we use the Big Book because the Big Book is the template for all 12-step programs. There was no 12-step programs prior to the Big Book. There was a 6-step program. The Oxford Group had that, and then Bill W., one of our co-founders, him and Dr. Bob, had gotten together, and they said, you know, we need a little bit more than that. And my understanding is when he sat down and wrote the 12 steps, it was almost like, I think the term is channeling. He sat down, probably, I think, in one fell swoop and wrote all 12 steps. So when I see things like that, I don't believe in coincidences or synchronicity. I really think that's God incognito. So we got the 12 steps, and they're in the Big Book, and then everything else derives from that understanding. So I like to use the original template. When I first get a spot, oh, and in the book it says, go find the prospect and start working on them. We don't hear that much. It also says that you go to the new man, and if he's not interested in what you have, it's okay. Go to the next person. We don't hear that a lot either. But I believe that's really the correct way how to do that. I don't really expect the new person to really understand the jargon, the culture, or what a sponsor does or doesn't do. They haven't got a clue. So they're told to sit in enough meetings, and eventually they're going to get the process through, like I got it initially, the process of osmosis. As if you sit in enough meetings, you're going to finally get enough of a clue what to do. Some places are different, and some places are better than others. Some sponsors are better than others. So this is some basic information that can help. So we have a thing called a beginner's chip. It's an outward sign of an inward commitment to try our way of life for 24 hours. 24 hours, guy, one day. Can you do one day? If you got the chip, if you got the keychain, you're ready to do something. You've been in enough pain or humiliation, you're ready to do something. And after we have the closing prayer, which is called a benediction, invocation. We invite the spirit. The benediction is to close it out that the spirit has been with us. So we do after the benediction in the room, I grab the fellow, the new man, he just got his chip. I usually do that. Now, the big book says you have a prospect, you go work with him and you talk with him, and it's good if they talk it out. If you let the other person talk, they'll tell you exactly where they're at and what they need. People don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. And listening is a big, big way of showing that you care for what somebody's going through. For me, it's easier to talk than to listen. So now I have the fellow by the hand, and we had the prayer, and I ask him, have you had enough? If he's had enough, he usually knows exactly what I'm talking about. If not, he'll ask the question, what do you mean? Have you had enough pain? Have you had enough humiliation? Have you had enough alcohol? Have you had enough? And sometimes I've had people say, yes, I have. And then I'll get people that say, well, no, not yet. They're not ready yet, and that's okay. Let's keep coming back. Come back to another meeting and go, you know, that's all you can really tell them. You sit down, you talk to them, see what their goals are. But if he says yes, then I ask him, are you willing to go to any length to achieve sobriety? Yes or no? Yes. I tell him you can get well from this disease of mind, body and spirit, but there's certain things you have to do. And the first thing I need you to do, and I carry them with me when I'm looking for a sponsee, Clancy Eyes, 7 questions. I have them on the website. It's under How to Find the Sponsee tab. It's in words, so you can print them out. Stephen Covey said, luck was nothing more when preparation met opportunity. So you're prepared. You've worked the steps. You've read the big book. You go to meetings on a regular basis, and you're in the process of even having had a spiritual awakening or in the process of having a spiritual awakening. The pamphlet in AA says a sponsorship is someone who has attained some recovery in AA and is willing to work with the newcomer on an ongoing basis in order to attain and maintain long-term sobriety. So there's not really a big demand of what you need to know, but I think there's a little bit more to it than that, but it's very casual. We have the casual understanding of sponsorship. So he says, yes, okay, I give him the 7 questions. Whip it out. There you go. I need these questions answered, and I need them back tomorrow. Here's my number. I expect your call. I'm done. If he really is ready and he can take simple instruction, he'll demonstrate his willingness to do this by getting the answers back. If I don't get them back, one of 2 things, he either is not ready or he's not ready for me. Sponsors come in all flavors and degrees of understanding, and personalities come into play, at least initially. Some people just don't like me. They don't know me. They don't like me. Some people get to know me. Then they don't like me. It's none of my business what you think of me because you think so little of me anyway. If not in stature, surely in time. Most people aren't really thinking about me. Sorry. They're too busy thinking about themselves. So I get them back, and we get started for a suggestion. And now they go. He went from prospect. I get back now. He's a sponsee. He's not a sponsee until he's done something. He's got to take a step. So I'll suggest that he gets a home group. And in the home group, to get the names of 20 or 30 men. I believe men with men and women with women usually work the best. It's easier to relate to the same gender. One. Two, sponsorship is an intimate relationship that could be easily misconstrued, causing some harm. So why put an extra hoop in there, an extra hoop to jump through if it's not necessary? The key is, though, is to work the steps. If you get a different gender sponsor, you know, if it's, you get a female sponsor, vice versa, the key is to work the steps. If that's not working out, you can always get another sponsor. You're not locked in. This is a casual agreement among adults. Excuse me. So now we have that, and then with the names of the men, to call them every day for the next 30 days and ask them to recite the third step prayer. Why do I have them do that? And I explain to them, it gets them used to picking up the 500-pound telephone and asking for help. It's hard for some of us. Two, it connects them up with their fellowship. They get to know his name, and he can get to know their name. Three, it encapsulates what we're going to try to accomplish by working all 12 steps. It's also called a surrender prayer because we got to surrender, folks. We got to surrender to win. As long as our ego is up there, we can't surrender. So we have to give up the ego, which is tough. That's a tough thing to do. And fourthly, the person he's calling might have been thinking about taking his first drink of alcohol. Chances are, with that call, he will not. So your sponsor is already into service work, which we found to be one of the immunities from alcoholism, intensive work with another alcoholic. This activity works when other activities fail, intensive work. And so we get them started quickly. And the prayer goes like this. God, I offer myself to thee to build with me and do with me as thy wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help, of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. May I do thy will always. Can I get an amen on that?
Amen, brother. Amen.
Thank you. Well, I hope you're still there, Mike. I was a little long-winded tonight. So I can't wait to hear what it was like and what happened and what it's like now. So tell us what it was like.
Okay. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, you sound great.
Okay. Well, my home phone died already, so I called you back on my cell phone. So.
Oh, good. Yeah, you sound good.
My name's Mike, and I'm an alcoholic. And
hello, Mike.
Hi, Mike.
I'm an alcoholic. I am not a drug addict. I'm one of those rare breeds that I don't think are quite as rare as I hear, but I used and abused every drug I could get near and never became addicted to any of them. But with alcohol, I couldn't do that. Let me start a little bit before what it was like. I don't have some long, tragic story. I'm a garden variety drunk who, prior to alcohol, always felt uncomfortable in my own skin. I didn't walk quite right. I didn't talk quite right. I wasn't quite smooth enough for the ladies. There was just nothing. There was no place I could find that I felt okay. Until I discovered sports when I was a youngster. And I found out that on a basketball floor, I felt okay, and that was really a strange feeling for me. And I found out that I was just as good as other people, and I didn't have that feeling of disconnect anymore. So I just started spending as much time on the basketball floor as I could. And I continued that through grade school. I continued that through junior high school. I continued that into high school.
Wow, you started in elementary school?
Pardon me?
You started in elementary school?
I started playing ball and basketball in elementary school. I had a couple guys that lived right across the street from me, and they were much older than I was, and they used to always play basketball up at this little grade school in their off time.
Well, both of these guys ended up being first-team All-State. And so what I would do as a kid is I would go up and I'd hang around with these guys. And I'd get in their way, every once in a while they'd show me something and they taught me how to shoot. One thing led to another. And so I just spent a lot of time at that grade school, which was only a half a block away from my house. So I was playing ball from a really young age. By the time I got to high school, I found out that I was not only as good as most people, I was better than most people on the basketball court. I'm going to make this fairly short. It went on to, I ended up being first team All-State in the state of Oregon. I ended up being Sport Magazine All-American. I ended up getting scholarship offers from all over the country. And all of a sudden, I didn't feel less than. So I went to college on a full athletic scholarship, and the first day of practice my sophomore year, I got hurt. And I got hurt bad enough that it ended basketball. And all of a sudden, I was that same scared little kid, because basketball was done. The one place in my life that I felt okay was gone. And so what I did at that point, because I'd only drank once before, is in college I was introduced to drinking. And I found out that I could drink pretty quick. You're talking to the two-time University of Puget Sound beer chugging champion. And all of a sudden, I could do something and people would cheer. And it was at that point that I realized that I didn't feel less than anymore. So I just drank as much as I could. Just like I played basketball as much as I could, I drank as much as I could. And I kept drinking and drinking and drinking. I became a bar bet. People like to go drinking with Mike because I could always win enough chugging beer to drink free for the whole night. So I just kept drinking and drinking and drinking more. Most of my college years, I can't remember anymore. I started smoking a lot of pot in college, and I started drinking a lot. I went from 6'4", 190 pounds to 6'4", 300 pounds. I went from being a star athlete to a hippie freak marching in anti-war protests, doing every drug I could get my hands on, but always drinking a lot. I came to college for my senior year, and by that time they had cut my scholarship. I was going to school on grants and aids. I came to school my senior year to sign up for all the paperwork, and they said, "Sorry, Mike, we don't have any paperwork for you. We don't have any loans for you. My parents couldn't afford it." Well, probably what happened is the previous year when I was supposed to be signing up for all this stuff, I was out drunk someplace. So I'm in my senior year, and I've got no money, and I can't get into college. Well, I got into this business intern program where they put you in a job, you go to school for a semester, you go to the job for a semester, back to school, back to the job. And I had been doing that for a year, so I simply called the bank, and I said, "Listen, my money didn't come through. Can I go to work for you full-time?" And they said yes, and I never looked back. And I stayed with that bank for quite a while. Well, in banking, a big portion of banking is soliciting new customers, and a big part of soliciting new customers is taking them out for drinks. And once I got to the point in banking where I was a branch manager and I controlled the expense account, I just drank more and more and more and more. And I started making a lot of stupid loan decisions over 5 martini lunches, and I got in a lot of trouble, and I drank myself right out of that career. Well, I went to get a job at another bank, and the bank told me, "I'm sorry, Mike, we like everything about you, but we're going to have to fire you." After I'd been on the job for a week, they fired me. And I didn't know why. Actually, I didn't know why. They checked with the previous bank, and they found all the problems I had had at that bank. And so then I'm sitting in my basement of my beautiful home, and I can't get a job because I'm going to get a shitty job recommendation from every place I go. So I just sat there and drank and drank and drank and drank. And I was drinking, I'd start drinking at about 10 o'clock in the morning, and I'd stop drinking when I passed out that night. And my next-door neighbor owned a car dealership. And one day he told me, he said, "Mike, I got a company you might be interested in talking to," because I had told him I was on a sabbatical. And so I said, "Yeah." So I went and talked to this company. Long story short, they hired me. They flew me to Chicago. I interviewed with them. And now I'm out of the banking industry, and I'm in the insurance industry. And I'm a finance and insurance specialist. And that's the guy that when you go buy a car, the last guy you talk to is a finance and insurance manager who tries to sell you a lot of insurance products and convince you that that's the way to go. and I was a specialist in that field. So I stayed with that company for a while, and I did pretty good. I got it to the point where I was training other people how to do what I had done, and I was pretty good at it. I'm a good talker. So one thing led to another, and I got a call from a company in L.A., and they said, I think you'd be interested in being our national training director. So I flew down there, and I ended up taking a job with an insurance company as the national training director of that company. And about 3 months into the job, I get a knock on my door, and I open the door, and I'm staring at the biggest badge I've ever seen in my life, and it was the Federal Bureau of Investigation. And what they were there to talk about was some of the loan decisions I had made way back in that first bank, and some of them were really bad. So what ended up happening is they charged me with a felony. I ended up going through a trial. I ended up pleading nolo contendere. And the insurance company, much to my surprise, said as long as you keep it out of the papers, you got a job. So I ended up staying with that insurance company. I did very well until the point where my wife hated living in L.A. So I talked to the insurance company. They created a position back in the Northwest, and we moved back. And all this time, I was drinking and drinking and drinking and drinking. I had one-year period where my wife was giving me so much heat about the amount I was drinking, I decided I was going to stop. And I had no trouble whatsoever stopping, because I smoked pot on a daily basis all day, every day, even while I was working. And I went on the marijuana maintenance program. And that lasted for just short of a year until I started drinking again. So they created a position for me in the Northwest. I came back up there, and all of a sudden the insurance company I was working for went under. So I'm out of a job again. So I figured, well, I'll start my own company. I've been doing pretty well at training other people how to do that job, so I started a training organization. I had trained for agents all over the country, and so I had contacts all over the country, so I contacted a lot of them, and I set up training arrangements with them on contract basis. So now I've got my own company, and I'm doing fine, except for the fact that my drinking has just gotten worse and worse and worse and worse. And this whole time, I did not consider I had a drinking problem. You could have put me on a lie detector, and I swear to God, the lie detector wouldn't say that I was lying when I said I do not have a problem with alcohol. So anyway, my wife is hitting me up more and more and more to stop drinking, and finally she hit me with a separation. In order to kind of stave that off, I decided I'd try a grandstand play. So I told my wife, you know, I got a problem with drugs and alcohol. I think I need to go into treatment. I checked myself into a treatment center knowing I wasn't an alcoholic. There was not a chance in the world I was an alcoholic. I was just drinking like I wanted to drink. Yeah, I'd gotten some trouble.
Just to keep her quiet, right? You did that just to keep your wife had become unmanageable?
To try to keep my marriage together.
Right.
I checked myself into it. So I went into treatment, and I played their stupid little games, and it was an inpatient treatment for a little over a month in a hospital. And like I said, I just played their stupid little games because I wasn't an alcoholic. All those other people were, but I wasn't. And halfway through that treatment program, they've got a family get-together where you get together with your wife and you sit down and you talk about how wonderful it's going to be when you get out of treatment, how you're going to take the kids to the zoo, and everything's going to be great. So she comes in, and the first words out of her mouth were, I want a divorce. I'm 2 weeks into a hospital. My wife just hit me for a divorce, and it was at that point that it just dropped me to my knees. And I can remember going up to my hospital room, and I can remember standing, looking out the window, because I was an agnostic. I didn't believe in God. Or there was no proof to me that God existed. And I can remember standing in that hospital room, looking out the window, asking God to talk to me. And he didn't. I wanted some meat and bones on God. I wanted him to talk to me, and he didn't. But I was just brought to my knees, and it was at that point that I stopped screwing around with treatment, and I did what they told me to do. I got up when I was supposed to get up. I did all of the exercises. It was a 12-step-based treatment center. In that treatment center, I went through steps 1 through 8. I did a fifth. It was a Hazelden program, though. It wasn't the big book.
It's okay.
And I don't say that to knock Hazelden, because I think it's a fine program. I'm just saying that because it wasn't the big book. But I took steps 1 through 8 in the treatment center. I did my 5th step with a minister at the treatment center. I did 6 and 7 in the chapel at the treatment center, which was a hospital. But when I came out of treatment on a Wednesday, I didn't have any place to go because my ex-wife, soon-to-be ex-wife, wouldn't let me come home. Well, a guy had approached me in the treatment center. Every Saturday night they had an AA meeting that we went to. I got called on at that meeting. I wasn't much for talking at that time, but I got called on. And I told my story about how she hit me with a divorce, that horrible bitch. I don't have any place to go. And this guy walked up to me and said, "Listen, Mike, if you need a place to stay, you can sleep on my couch for a few days." And so when I came out of the treatment center, I moved into a guy's house that I didn't even know. And I slept on his couch for about a week until I got this little crappy apartment. But the day I came out of treatment, which was Wednesday at noon, I left treatment, and that night I went to my first outside treatment center AA meeting. Because my counselor had told me, go to 90 meetings in 90 days. And a lot of people hate that in AA. They think that's just a bunch of crap. Well, it may be crap, but I bought into it, and I went to the 90 meetings in 90 days. And the first meeting I ever went to was a men's group that happened at 7:30, which was 7 hours after I came out of treatment. So I go to my first AA meeting outside of treatment, and I was expecting to see something radically different than what I saw. I was expecting to see a bunch of old drunks sitting there dripping spit on their shoes. And what I ran into was I met one guy who ended up being my doctor for the next 20 years. I met another guy who was an engineer who built the biggest bridge in the state of Oregon. I met a couple guys that worked for the railroad. I met a couple guys that worked for a local mill. It was just a cross-section of people. But one thing, and I'll never forget this, and I wish every meeting in the country did this, part of their format was you had to hold your hand up if you were new, which I did. And part of their format was, for all the new people, please come up to the desk after the meeting so we can get you a temporary sponsor. And I
wish I love that.
I love that.
That's a great idea.
Unfortunately, I haven't seen that much anywhere else. So anyway, at the end of the
I've never seen that.
I'm ready to duck out the back door, and the meeting ends. We say the Lord's Prayer. I start to duck out the back door, and this guy grabs me by the elbow and says, "Come on, Mike, let's go get your sponsor." And he walked me up to the front desk. And on my first meeting of AA, I was assigned a sponsor.
I love it.
Now, he didn't turn out to be my long-term sponsor, but what he did turn out to be was somebody who could educate me about what a sponsor is. We sit back in Alcoholics Anonymous, and we expect people to come up, just listen for a while, wait till you hear somebody who's got something you want, and then go ask them to be your sponsor. Well, if that would have been me day one, I want some guy who's got a lot of money, a hot-looking wife, and a nice car. I don't know what a sponsor is.
Exactly.
So this guy talked
to me. I love that. That's great.
Well,
it's called a temporary sponsor. I mean, you know, like I tell people you could be a temporary sponsor, but all sponsorship is temporary anyway. It's either temporary for a day, temporary for a lifetime, or temporary for anywhere in between. But the key is to get started. Go ahead, Mike. That's great. I love the story. Yeah, getting started.
So I picked a guy who didn't want to sponsor me. There was this old boy named Jack F. Everybody called him Foghorn because when he talked, he sounded like a foghorn. And I remember seeing him in a meeting early on, real early on. And he sat there for about half the meeting, didn't say a word. About halfway into the meeting, and it was a meeting where you volunteer to talk. And about halfway into the meeting, he goes, "My name's Jack, and I'm an alcoholic, and I can't believe I just sat through half an AA meeting and nobody mentioned the steps, and nobody mentioned the big book, and nobody mentioned sponsoring newcomers." And then he just went on a tirade. And I thought, this is the guy I want to be my sponsor. So I walked up to him, and I said, "Jack, you're going to be my sponsor." And he said, "No, I'm not." I said, "Yeah, you are." And he said, "No, I'm not." And we went back and forth. I'm a better talker than he is, so I talked him into being my sponsor. And so he said, okay, what are you doing tomorrow, kid? And he always called me kid. He never called me Mike. The whole time he was my sponsor, he always called me kid. So what are you doing tomorrow night, kid? I said, nothing. And he said, okay, meet me in the parking lot here at the church. We're going to go to a meeting. So I go, great. So the next night, I show up at the church parking lot, and he drives up, and he walks up to me, and he looks down at my shoes. And he said, well, you ready? And I said, yeah, I'm ready. And he looks down at my shoes again. I said, what the hell are you looking at? He said, I'm looking at your shoes. He said, well, why are you looking at my shoes? He says, tonight we're going to go to a place called Hooper Detox, and there's a good chance somebody's going to puke on your shoes, and I just want to know what kind of money you're going to lose. And he took me to a detox center that was beyond anything I could ever imagine. I mean, it was the low-bottom drunk detox center in Portland, Oregon. And I stayed with that guy, and he would drag me out on 12-step calls where we were going into hotels and dragging people out of hotels and getting them into detox and dragging people out of hotels and getting them home to go to bed. And I went on all of these 12-step calls with this guy. But I'm the guy who, I did 8 steps, and I had done part of my amends, but I never did the steps according to the big book. So finally I said, Jack, I want to go back, and I want to take all 12 steps according to the big book. He said, well, it's about time you asked me that, kid. And so he took me, and he took me through all 12 steps of the big book very quickly. And he would not let me shirk any of my responsibilities on my amends. He stayed right on top of me.
How long, Mike? How long did it take you to get through all 12 the second time?
About a week.
Okay.
I took the slow route. Took me about a week. Well, actually, it took me a week to do 1 through 8. 9 took some time because I had some serious big-time amends to make. And so 9 took some time, but then he immediately got me into 10, 11, and 12 and doing the nightly written inventory and that whole thing and praying to a God that I really still didn't have a handle on, but praying to a God. And he said the same thing to me that my counselor in treatment said, Mike, if you don't believe in God, just act as if there is a God. And both of them said, is there a chance in hell that you're wrong? Is there a 1 in a million chance that you're wrong and there actually is a God? And I said, well, yeah, there's that chance, and that's all the willingness I needed. So I took care of all of my amends. I started getting into 10, 11, and 12. And all of a sudden, one day, I'm about three, four months sober. And about 3, 4 months sober, it just came to me one day, you know, I haven't even thought about drinking. The thought of drinking hasn't even entered my mind. And then Jack pointed out to me in the big book where it said exactly that. For by this time, sanity will have returned. We will seldom be interested in liquor. If tempted, we recoil as if from a hot flame. And then the top of the next page, it says the problem has been removed. It does not exist for us. And I realized I wasn't thinking about drinking. And then a couple months later, I realized that all the time I wanted to believe in God, I had God in my head, but I didn't have God inside me. And I was reading the 24-hour day book every day, and I had been given another devotional by a guy named Oswald Chambers that I'd been reading every day. And all of a sudden, I realized that God wasn't a mental thing for me anymore. I knew God existed. And I also was really involved with a group of people that like to argue. And they like to argue a lot. And it was a big book study group. And I went to that big book study group every week. And after the big book study group every week, we'd all go out to coffee at Denny's, and we'd spend the next 3 hours arguing about the big book. And I'd hear this stuff in AA meetings that to me was like an epiphany. I'd hear some brilliant thing in an AA meeting. And I go to Jack, and I say, Jack, God, you're not even going to believe this. And I tell him what I heard. And he said, well, where'd you hear that? And I said, I heard it in an AA meeting. And he said, well, where is that in the book? And I said, well, I'm not sure. And he said, well, go find it. And so I poured through the book, and I couldn't find it. A slow growth is a healthy growth. That was one of my epiphanies. So I go look in the book, and I couldn't find it. And I go back to Jack, and he'd say, well, did you find it? And I'd say, no. And he'd say, you know why? And I'd say, no, why?
It's not there.
Because it's not there. And every time I had a new epiphany, I'd take it to Jack. He'd send me to the find it. I wouldn't find it. And he'd tell me the reason I didn't find it is it's not there. And I realized, finally, it took me a while, but I realized finally that everything you hear in an AA meeting is not necessarily true.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to learn that for myself. So two things happened. One, I learned that. And the second thing, as many times as Jack sent me back to the Big Book to find this stuff, and as much time as I was spending in this Big Book study group, I got to know the Big Book pretty damn well. Well, I know now that knowing the Big Book won't keep you sober. Doing the Big Book will. And I was doing the Big Book. I was doing everything these guys told me to do. Jack wasn't a kind guy. He wasn't the lovey-dovey sponsor that a lot of people seem to want these days. When I told Jack something, or I'd share something in a meeting, and I went through all this self-help stage where I was reading Melody Beattie and Bradshaw and all these self-help books, and I spout this stuff in AA meetings, and Jack would come up to the meeting afterwards and go, you know, kid, you're full of shit. You need to stop talking and start listening. And he was that kind of sponsor, and that's the kind of guy I needed. And Jack was my sponsor until he died several years ago. But I ended up changing my home group. I got pissed off one time at a meeting that I was at, and the old deal about a coffee pot and a resentment, and two of us started a new group. And that's been my home group now for 23 years. And what I found was, however, is that my home group was a suburbs meeting. And I call it a suburbs meeting because primarily what it was recovered people from the suburbs who all got together, and it was a daily meeting. We had it 7 days a week. But it was all these recovered people who got together and shared their story. But as far as newcomers, I wasn't spotting any, or very few. So I found this little club in Vancouver, Washington, and they have, let's see, 8 times 7, they have 56 meetings a week, and they're stuffed with newcomers. So I decided I'm going to start spending some time at this club. So I talked to the guy who kind of ran the club, and he was in the process of trying to get a bunch of old-timers to take over different meetings. So I took one over. And I'm pretty predictable when I share in an AA meeting. Bill W. said, sobriety, freedom from alcohol through the teaching and practices of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous is the sole purpose of the group. The teaching and practices of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I'm predictable. That's all I ever talking about, is the teaching and the practices of the 12 steps. So I go into this club and I share that when I got called on. And inevitably, every meeting or every other meeting that I was at, after the meeting, some newcomer, and the club was stuffed with newcomers, would walk up to me and they'd say, would you be interested in being my sponsor? And I'd say, sure. But I'd say, the first thing we got to do is we got to go have a cup of coffee, because I'm going to explain to you how I sponsor people, and by the end of that explanation, you may want to throw me out the door. The first 5 years I was sober, I was the world's worst sponsor. Everybody I sponsored got drunk. It was a joke in Vancouver. Hell, you want to get drunk? Just have Mike be your sponsor. But it wasn't working. I was staying sober, but they weren't. And I had the opportunity to sit down with a guy when I was about 5 or 6 years sober. And the guy had 30-some years of sobriety. And I was sitting in this little club talking to him, and I was explaining to him that everybody I was sponsoring was getting drunk. And he said, well, how are you sponsoring people? And I explained it to him. And he said, well, let me tell you how I sponsor people. Now, I'm going to get in. I don't know if anybody I know is going to listen to this, but I'll get a bunch of heat once they hear it. for people in the rowdy rum are hearing this, I've talked enough about this in the rowdy rum to know that I'm going to get some heat from the people in the rowdy rum about this. But so be it. There's a bazillion ways to sponsor people. I found one that works. Other people have other ways that work. I'm all for them. I'm AA. I didn't need another program. I didn't need Celebrate Recovery. I didn't need SOS. I didn't need Alcoholics Victorious. I didn't need any of the other programs. I hope they all work. I really do. I hope every one of them works and helps people get sober. But all I needed was AA. And the way this guy told me he sponsored people, and this is exactly how I've been doing it for the last 20 years, and I don't get people sponsored sober. I'm just kind of the tour guide. I just kind of guide them through the steps. And I don't take credit for these people getting sober because it's God who gets people sober, not me. It's my job. Hopefully the steps are going to take an agnostic to God. They're going to take a believer to a better position with God. Periodically, they're going to take an atheist to God. And this nonsense about agnostics and atheists can't get sober in AA, well, boy, that's news to me, because I've seen a lot of them get sober in AA. Recently, I've seen two groups that just get pounded in AA. People will come up to the atheists and agnostics, and they'll just pound them. You got to believe in God. If you don't believe in God, you're going to get drunk and you're going to die. Well, that hasn't been my experience. The other group that, and I don't know, maybe this is a regional thing. I think it is a regional thing, but another group that gets pounded is Christians. It's okay if you're a Buddhist or a Hindu or a Wiccan or a pagan, but if you're a Christian, don't mention that in an AA meeting because somebody's going to come after the meeting, and they have to me and told me, Mike, you shouldn't be talking about Christianity. And all I said was, I'm a Christian. I didn't proselytize. I didn't try to drag anybody into Christianity kicking and screaming. I just said, my God's a Christian God. That's it. So anyway, the way this guy showed me how to sponsor, and this is what I do today. When somebody says I'm going to sponsor, they want me to sponsor them, I take them out and I explain this whole process that I'm about to lay out. And I say, that's the only way I know how to do it. I know it works. I get them to admit that they're willing to go to any lengths to get it. I take them straight to page 44. And on page 44, this is while we're having coffee. At the top of page 44, the two questions. When you want to stop entirely, can you? And once you start drinking, do you have any control over the amount you drink? And I found out something was happening that was kind of bizarre, because this wasn't supposed to happen. I asked them both questions on alcohol and both questions on drugs. When I ask them the questions on alcohol, almost all of them say, no, I couldn't quit entirely, and no, I can't control the amount I drink. When I asked them the questions on drugs, about half of them said, well, yeah, I can control the amount of drugs I use, and there's several drugs that I've quit already. So I found this dichotomy, and it's my opinion, and this is my opinion, not everybody's opinion, it's my opinion that there is a large percentage of people that identify in an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting as alcoholic and addict that are truly alcoholics who use and abuse drugs but were not addicted. That's my personal opinion. So I take them to page 44. If they answer no to either one of those questions, then I'm ready to move forward. And the very next available day that they have, hopefully it'll be tomorrow, the very next available day they have, I say, okay, you're going to meet me at breakfast at Smitty's in Camas, Washington at 8:30 in the morning, and you're going to spend all day with me. And they say, fine. So we meet at breakfast. And at breakfast, we take steps 1, 2, and 3. Very simple. I don't have them write a bunch of stuff. I just, there's a series of things I go through which are too lengthy to, it's all straight out of the big book, too lengthy to go into here, but I take them through steps 1, 2, and 3, and we're normally done with 1, 2, and 3 before breakfast is done. I then take them straight to my house, I've got a little room out at the end of my deck. I'm sitting in it right now. Got a glass door on it, and it says Mike's Cigar Room. And I take them into my cigar room, and I pull out, I've already printed them, I pull out Joe and Charlie's worksheets for doing a fourth step. And
there
I explain how to do it. I explain Joe and Charlie's worksheets to them. I give them a clipboard with worksheets with plenty of extras in case they got to run over four, five, six pages on any one resentment or fear or whatever. And I have them write a four-step right in my cigar room. We normally hit my cigar room about 10 o'clock in the morning. Usually, by 1 or 2 in the afternoon, they're done with their four-step. Straight writing. No breaks except to go to the bathroom. No procrastination. They're not going to write for a while and sit it down and write for a while and sit it down and write for a while and sit it down over a number of months. They're going to write it right now. And they write their entire four-step. As soon as they're done with the four-step, we sit down in my cigar room, and I hear their fifth step. Once I've heard the entire fifth step, I explain to them how six and seven work. I want them to take an hour, and I want them to go back over steps one through five and just make sure they feel good about everything they've done, and there's nothing else that they need to cover on those first five steps. And once that hour's over, we do the sixth and seventh step.
Let me ask you this. Now, are they alone? You just say, okay, I want you to take an hour of contemplative meditation. I want you to consider all this, and you need you to take an hour to do that. Is that how you work it?
Exactly. I show them the page in the book
okay.
where it talks about going home. Well, in my
yeah.
case, they don't go home. I leave
Get
the room.
Get here.
And about an hour later, I come back in. And I ask them
right.
to go back
okay.
over everything, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. 8 is for the most part done as the harms list on 4. But I go to 8, and I see if there's anything else we need to add to that. Now, by this time, it's about 6, 7 o'clock at night. So then we take their 8th step, and we draw up a game plan as to how they're going to do all these amends. And we break them down into immediate. We break them down into monetary amends. We break them down into ones that they're not going to be able to do immediately, but maybe they can do with a phone call or a letter. But we set up a game plan as to how they're going to do all their amends. And that normally takes about an hour. At that point, I fully explain to them 10, 11, and 12. I show them how to do the written inventory. I give them a written inventory sheet that they fill out. Even at this point, if they don't believe in God, I still come up with a couple or three prayers for them to do, and I say, I want you to do these every day, whether you believe it or not. Just take some time, and I also want you to, every day, take about 15 to 30 minutes and just sit and either think about something having to do with recovery or try to clear your mind entirely. I explain a little bit about meditation. And then we lay out some things to do on the 12th step. And by that time, it's about 8 o'clock at night. So from 8 in the morning till 8 at night, we go through all 12 steps. And I would venture to say that I do it at least as thoroughly as anybody does it who takes a month or two. Because if you take, generally, if you're going to take a month to do the steps, you don't have 12 hours face-to-face with your sponsee. Some do if they read the book page by page, but most don't. But I got 12 hours face-to-face with this guy. And, again, I don't get people sober, but I would venture to say, if I was to estimate over the last 20 years, and it's the only way I've sponsored for the last 20 years, and I've sponsored a lot of people, I would venture to say probably 90% of them are still sober. And the ones I lose because they will not do their nine-step amends, or they fall away on 10, 11, and 12. And I still do that today. Right now, I just finished the steps with a guy. So now I got to go back down to the club. And I don't wait for somebody to come ask me. I go fishing for sponsees. I know if I go into that club and I talk about recovery, all those poor suckers are looking for is hope. That's all we got to offer them. When they first walk in the door, we got hope to offer them. And if I can give somebody hope, they're going to walk up to me after the meeting, or I'm going to walk up to them if they've identified themselves as a newcomer. And every other time I go in there, I've picked up 3-4 sponsees in a day. They're easy to find if you go looking for them. Unfortunately, what most alcoholics do is they sit back and they wait for the sponsee to come to them. Well, sponsee doesn't know what they're looking for, so I go to them instead. And sponsoring people, I'm pretty aggressive about it. I only know one way to do it. That first 5 years, everybody I was sponsoring got drunk. Since then, everybody stays sober. And I've heard a lot of other good ways to sponsor people, but I don't need it because the way I'm doing it works. Just like I don't need Celebrate Recovery, which I understand is a fine program. I don't need Alcoholics Victorious. I've been to a couple of their meetings. I've been to a couple Celebrate Recovery meetings. They look great to me. I've never been to Passages in Malibu, but it costs you about $1 billion just to go there. But you know what? I hope that works, too. I hope they all work, because there's way too many alcoholics. And unfortunately, there's a danger period. In Alcoholics Anonymous, there's a danger period, and I sit and I watch it over and over and over again. From the time a person walks into a meeting for their first time, they have a window of opportunity. From the time they walk in their first time till the time they hook up with a good sponsor to take the steps is a damn dangerous time for those poor guys. And unfortunately, what I see far too often is they walk into a meeting, they maybe walk into two, they maybe walk into three, and they walk out the door before they're ever hooked up with a sponsor and have an opportunity to get a dangerous time. And we do a shitty job of filling up that dangerous time. Unfortunately, you know, there's a lot of great AA meetings everywhere, and there's a lot of shitty AA meetings everywhere. Now, I hear people say, no, there's no such thing as a shitty AA meeting. Well, that's not my experience. I've sat through a lot of them. I've sat through
The people who say that haven't been around long enough.
Yeah. I sat in one meeting at my home group one time, and I finally went ballistic and stopped this crap. It's an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, and the person who chaired the meeting, all he spoke about was cocaine. Now, I don't have a problem with somebody talking about drugs in an AA meeting. I don't have a problem with that at all. I have a problem with them dwelling on drugs in an AA meeting. And all they talked about was cocaine. And the second person who shared, all they talked about was cocaine. And the third person, all they talked about. And I kept watching this kid. And this kid was shaking. And he could barely hold a coffee cup. And he was a drunk. And he had this quizzical look on his face like, what the hell have I walked into? And finally, after about three people had shared, I just blurted in. I just interrupted. I said, my name's Mike. I'm an alcoholic. And I'm an alcoholic, so I'm going to talk about alcohol. I'm not going to talk about cocaine anymore. And I went nuts. I have a tendency to do that very often. And after the meeting, I walked up to that kid, and I talked to him, I sponsored him, and he got sober, and now he's sponsoring other people. And that's the way AA is supposed to work. Again, I don't have a problem with people who are dual addicted in AA. I don't have a problem with people bringing up, mentioning their drug use in AA. I have a problem when... I think NA and CA may have a problem in that a lot of their really quality people, that ought to be an NA and CA sponsoring people, they're not there. They're an AA. A lot of those hardcore drug addicts, they can really be doing some good work in NA and CA, but they're not there. They're in AA for whatever reason. So what
the
I'm
track record, we have a better track record. That's what it is. We have more meetings in more places, and we have a better track record. So they're going to go where the greatest number of people go. A crowd accumulates a crowd, which accumulates a crowd. That's what I found.
Yep. And that's true. But I also have told a lot of people, and if they don't like to hear it, I don't care. I mean, I've sponsored people who are alcoholics, but what brought them to their knees was crack cocaine. Also,
right.
If they're an alcoholic, I'll sponsor them. If they're a pure drug addict, I don't. Not because I'm a jerk, but because of the fact that I'm not a drug addict. That's a whole different world to me. But I've told a lot of those people, you need to be in NA. Nobody's going to throw you out of AA. But you need to be in NA because you could help a lot of people over there. I mean, we could all help. I mean, could you imagine? We got, what, about 2 million members in AA. Could
right.
you imagine what would happen if within the next week every member of Alcoholics Anonymous sponsored somebody? Could you imagine that?
Oh, it would explode.
It would explode.
The fellowship would explode. Yeah, it would explode. And that's where it was supposed to go. What's happened now, and I don't know if you know this or not, in 1981 they did a census, the GSO, I've verified this many times, there was 2 million in the rooms. They did another survey, census, at GSO, counting cats. Now, I understand that. January 2010, 2,100,000. In those 29 years, the word population has increased by a full third. So if we flatlined, we should have had 3 million. That's a lot of dead
exactly.
folks.
Exactly. And I'm not saying this to bad. I mean, I love Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm not saying this to badmouth Alcoholics Anonymous. I posted in the Rowdy Rum one day, and, you know, the Rowdy Rum for me has been a godsend because I live way up in the mountains. Okay, I'm an hour drive from my home group. I live on a little river. I've been incredibly blessed. I love where I live. But the Rowdy Rum has been a godsend to me for a couple reasons. Number one, it was given to me. I didn't form the Rowdy Rum. I mean, people say, well, this is Mike's room. Yeah, kind of, because it was given to me. But there are so many incredibly smart people with tremendous recovery. And they're always, those people are always in there. And there's also a lot of people that don't go to AA and don't go to NA and don't go to CA and don't believe in God. And the room was designed not to discuss Alcoholics Anonymous. The room was designed to debate recovery issues. And we get heated in there sometimes. We get people on one side of an issue debating with people on the other side of the issue, and we all are passionate about our beliefs, and sometimes things get crazy. You know, we've got 17 administrators in that room, and sometimes it's kind of like herding cats, because we want active debate, but we don't want people starting name-calling or obscenities or stuff like that. But it's been a godsend for me for a couple reasons. One, I've learned an incredible amount from some really, I know the Big Book, but there's people in that group who know the Big Book 10 times better than I do. And I've learned so much from those people. And I've also learned so much from the people that I totally disagree with. And one thing that I've learned is I am much more tolerant today than I was when I first showed up in the Rowdy Rum. You have to be, or you get your head torn off.
Well,
and
they call that what the elder statesman.
You know, I don't think I'm not quite that yet, well yet, Joseph. But I'm a lot better than I used to be. I mean, there's some people in there that I really truly enjoy and really like. We just got back from a 2-month trip in a motorhome, and I got together with a lot of people from the Rowdy Rum as I went around the country. Got to meet them face to face. Sat down and had dinner with them. It was a wonderful time. And there were some other people that I don't dislike them. I just disagree with their vision of what AA is all about. And they may be AA members, but I just so disagree with them. And it's good for me to hear all of those people that I disagree with. And again, I'm not great at it, but I'm getting a whole lot better at just holding my tongue and keeping my fingers off of the keyboard and not firing back a little zinger. I can be really sarcastic at times. That's one of my character defects. But I'm getting better at that. And I learned a little bit of that in AA. I learned more in the Rowdy Rum. You know, AA did for me way more than just get me sober. AA, I quit drinking when I was 37 years old. I read Chuck C's A New Pair of Glasses in my first year of sobriety. And I read how Chuck ran his company. He used to design grocery stores. That's what he did for a living. And the way he ran his company was he just tried to help people accomplish what they were trying to accomplish. And so next time they needed to accomplish something, they called him. He didn't have to go chasing business. Well, I owned my own company, and my idea of business was get my hand as far into the client's pocket as I can get and get as much money out as I can get it. So I thought, you know, I'm going to give this a try. I'm going to try to run my company like Chuck C. ran his. And so I started concentrating on helping my clients accomplish what they were trying to accomplish. And a funny thing happened. I didn't have to do any more prospecting anymore. I go to client A and I say, you know, I've been trying to get in to see this guy for a long time and I can't get past his secretary. You know him, don't you? And he goes, sure. I said, would you mind giving him a call and just telling him our relationship and how it's going? He'd pick up the phone, he'd call the guy, and I'd be in front of the guy the next day getting a new piece of business. And because of that, my business exploded. In 13 years, I was able, from coming out of treatment, living in a little shitty apartment with about $3,000 in the bank. I wasn't a low-bottom drunk, but I had about $3,000 in the bank. From that, in 13 years, I retired at 50.
Wow.
It was all because of the fact that I reformulated my business model to be of service to other people. And today, that's what it's all about. Try to help other people. I don't always accomplish it. Sometimes I can still be a jerk. But for the most part, I just try to help other people. That's I don't have to work, and I got a lot of time on my hands. And I can't tell you how many phone calls I've had simply off the rowdy rum with people that were having problems. Problems they didn't want to talk about in the rowdy rum. And they'd send me a private message, and I'd talk to them for a little bit, and I'd send them back my phone number. Next thing you know, we're talking on the phone, and we're going through the kind of crap that they don't want to talk about in an open forum. And a lot of times, you know, all those people need is somebody to listen to them. That's all they want to do is just somebody to listen to them. And that may be outside of my concepts of AA. My concept of AA is people new coming in the door, whether they're coming in on a court slip or whatever. If they're coming into AA and they got a problem with alcohol, they want hope. And hope is the best thing we have to sell people.
Yeah, that's what we sell. We sell hope. People don't care how much you know until they know how much you care, and that's because you're taking time to listen to what they have to say. Most folks can work out a lot of the stuff on their own once they have someone that's willing to listen. That's one. Two, you know, the thing I like the most about the rowdy rum is really goes along with the traditions. You know, we believe that there isn't a fellowship on earth which lavishes more devoted care upon the individual's member. Surely there's none which more jealously guards the individual's right to think, talk, and act as he wishes. No AA can compel another to do anything. Nobody can be punished or expelled. Our 12 steps to recovery are suggestions, and our 12 traditions which guarantee AA's unity contains not a single don't. They repeatedly say, we ought, but never we must. See, talk. You know,
exactly.
That's what I like about the, you know, that's AA. You know, okay, so sometimes you got to cut them short and say, okay, you're a little way over base, but most of the time, I think most people are fairly polite. You do a great job keeping people, I call it the veneer of civility. Usually people come up with arguments, and if they can't continue the argument, they take a personal attack. That's my experience, which is uncalled for. That's not necessary.
Once the gas runs out of the facts in an argument, it always devolves into insults and personal attacks, and then the whole debate might as well stop. And I've seen mellowing on a number of people on the other side of issues for me also. I've seen I've seen, well, there's a couple people right now in the rowdy realm that I'm kind of sideways with. And I mean, I don't mean sideways where I got a resentment against them or anything like that. I just mean that we kind of reached a point where it was just easier to not talk to each other than to talk to each other.
I know.
And I don't like that, and I'm pretty sure they don't like that either. But many times, it's kind of funny, many times the people that I will get to that point with, whether it be here in Washougal, Washington, or on the Rowdy Rum, or in the Fellowship of AA, many times the people that I get to that point with are people that are remarkably similar to me.
Interesting that you should notice that.
Remarkably similar.
Usually we don't get to notice that.
I notice
so good for you.
It because I've seen it often enough to know to look for it now. I make a comment periodically that, you know, I know an awful lot about a little. And I know a little about an awful lot. I'm not a brilliant guy, but I'm relatively bright. And I'm not saying I'm brighter than everybody else. But I notice that when I run into somebody who comes across like they're the brightest bulb that ever existed in the universe, the hair on the back of my neck goes up. Because I like to think I'm bright. They want to tell me they're bright, and we just clash. Now, over time, it usually smooths out. But I look at stuff so radically different. I'm just not the guy I was while I was drinking. I was never a horrible guy. I was a liar. I did my share of stealing shit when I was young. I spent a little bit of time in jail, but I wasn't a horrible guy. And now I'm definitely not a horrible guy because there's an AA comedian that goes around the country. I can never remember what his name is, but he talks about first thought wrong and how when something would happen, immediately his first thought would be the wrong thought. And that's kind of the way I used to be. My first thought used to be wrong. A cashier gives me too much money back at the grocery store. First thought, damn, she gave me $20 too much. All right. That used to be my first thought. My first thought now is, excuse me, ma'am, I think you gave me too much change. And over time, it's not something I have to work at. It's just kind of an automatic.
Yeah, and they're surprised that you say it so quickly, too. That's like, they look at you like, who is this guy giving back money?
Yeah. Oh, I've told him, excuse me, you didn't charge me enough. I mean, if I'm gonna create a crime, I want at least $20 million with absolutely no chance of being caught.
The banks and the insurance companies, beware. But the Joe Blow on the street, you're safe. You know, there was a point that I wanted to elaborate on, and I think that was real important. You said that time that when the newcomer first comes into the meeting. And I've discerned that by the fact that with my sponsees, I usually ask them not to talk in a meeting until they've worked step five. Now, I do the 28-day deal. You know, we try to get through the steps in 28. Although I like yours. On the website, I have how to get somebody through in 24 hours just using the big book, the video and all that's on there. So that collaborates what you were saying. The first coming in, they're in a lot of pain. And I use that pain as fuel to get them through the steps. Once they start talking in the meetings and they're not drinking, that pain seems to dissipate. The pink cloud comes down and the motivation to do the steps also dissipate. Is that your experience as well?
They start getting comfortable. And I've heard one of my favorite speakers, and a lot of people don't like him, and I don't care. I've met him. I've met his brother. We've spent time together. It's Chris Raymer. And what Chris Raymer says, what I say now, too, and I've thought this for a long time. He says it more eloquently than I can. The time I want to get a guy starting the steps is when they're raw, in pain, and out of their minds in desperation. That's when I want to start, because if they sit around in meetings for 30 days and they talk a little bit and they manage to pull off not drinking, it's just like you said, the motivation to take the steps starts going away.
Yeah, they're not drinking, so all those problems are going away now. Plus, they're being accepted by a new tribe. You know, it's pretty heady. Oh, you got 15 minutes sober? Let's hear what you have to say. What does he got to say? Something you hadn't heard before? Oh, we need to hear that because we'll forget what it was like. Listen, lady, if you forgot what it was like, you didn't finish yet.
Well, the ones I don't set a limit on the ones I sponsor as far as when they talk, but what I do tell them is, and I just drill into them over and over and over again, sobriety, freedom from alcohol through the teaching and practices of Alcoholics Anonymous is the sole purpose of the group. And so I tell them, if you get called on in a meeting, if you want to mention, you know, you drank bad and you're working on your third step, or you drank bad and you've got a sponsor and you're going to start taking the steps tomorrow, great. But if you want to tell people, the string on my weed eater broke yesterday and it ruined my whole day, and then my girlfriend yelled at me, they don't need to hear that stuff.
No.
And they definitely don't need to hear how to drink. I don't have a problem. I mean, sometimes there's a newcomer that needs to talk and they have something that's just ripping their guts out. Their mom died. Their girlfriend was killed in a car wreck. Their child just came down with diabetes. I don't have a problem in the world somebody sharing that type of stuff at an AA meeting. I don't care how much time they've got.
That's a good point.
The primary purpose.
Yeah,
not
that's a
the
good
primary
point.
Purpose of the group.
Well, I like to think that AA meetings are a cross between a self-help group, a revival meeting, and group therapy.
You know,
that's
kind of funny.
That's not the intention, though, but that's the way it seems to have turned out.
Kind of weird, I've always thought, that a lot of bookstores always have their used copies of the big book in the self-help category.
Right.
And my experience is that AA is not a self-help program. AA is a God-help program. If I could help myself, I'd stick with reading Melody Beattie and Bradshaw and some of the other self-help books I used to. I couldn't get myself sober. And the only way I got sober and stayed sober was once I realized, you know, God really is real, and I don't feel like drinking. And then I used to think for the longest time God was the solution. Then I realized it was taught to me by someone who knew better than I did. And there's nothing wrong with teaching people things in AA. The big book doesn't say God is the solution. The big book says God and action are the solution.
Act right.
And I heard a guy say, one of our administrators, a guy named Lindsay, you know him.
Yeah.
Heard him say the other day, you've heard this thing about, you can't keep it until you give it away.
Exactly.
Everybody's heard that. Lindsay
reworded
it. Lindsay said, you haven't got it until you give it away.
Ah, I like that better.
I thought it was brilliant. And
yeah,
it
is.
I watched Lindsay when she came in. And some of the people who I've seen come in into AA and... I watched one guy come in. He was sleeping under a bridge. He was a Native American Indian, sleeping under the Burnside Bridge in Portland, Oregon. Dropped out of school when he was in grade school. stumbled into an AA meeting, got a good sponsor, got through the steps, went back and got his GED, but now he's got a high school diploma, got into an Indian Affairs program where he got his bachelor's degree at University of Washington. Then after he got his bachelor's degree in psychology at University of Washington, he got his master's degree in from the University of Washington in psychology. And now he's working as a tribe psychologist for a tribe, I believe, over in Montana. I mean, good grief, if a guy can come from no education, sleeping under a bridge, Native American, to a master's degree in psychology, this deal works for anybody. There's no discrimination as to who AA will work for. Just like there's no discrimination on who alcohol will kick their ass. Alcohol doesn't discriminate, and neither does AA. And it's available to everybody.
I like to think alcohol is an equal opportunity destroyer.
There you go. Perfect way to say it. Perfect way.
Harold, do you have any last comments before we close her down?
Well, I've enjoyed our program tonight, and I really agree. Not only can't we keep it if we don't give it away, we actually don't have it until we start giving it away. I tell a lot of people that what we're doing at the meetings is we're getting prepared so that we can work with others. And that's the real key to it. Action, action, action. Thanks, guys.
There you go. There you go.
Thanks, Harold.
And that, I think, one last thing. I think that action portion of it, I think, is a big part of why Alcoholics Anonymous works so well for agnostics and atheists. They have whatever psychic change is necessary for them to get into the action phase of AA, and once they're in the action phase, they do fine.
Yeah, I write it this way: we're saved by grace after all that we can do, not after all that we can talk, not after all that we can think, not even after all that we can pray. The magic words in AA is action and more action, for faith without works is dead.
Perfect.
Well, thank you so much, Mike. It's really been good. You know your stuff, kiddo. Kid.
Okay, I appreciate it. Great talking to you. Harold, great talking to you.
Thank you, and God bless.
Okay, same
in closing, you. In closing, we'll tell you that Rum Radio is in 151 foreign countries, including Mississippi, 2,800 towns, cities, and villages, and we're between 300,000 and 400,000 hits to the website. There's no money being made, and we're anonymous to the 11th tradition on the website. Didn't work out that well on Facebook, but we're real popular in Nepal. You know why? They like our yak. No, we really are in Nepal. So if you need some sponsorship information, this is a good place to look. Thanks, guys, and have a great night. Good night.
Good night.
Good night.